biology major at Harvard and meatloaf understudy are just two of the past lives of our guest this time, Doug Hughes. The Tony Award-winning director is in Dublin at the moment to direct Arthur Miller's 1968 The Price at the Gate, and he spoke to me about the sounds of that play, as well as his own winding route into directing. What larks!
This was a play that he tried to make, to have comedy in it. And one of the ways he added comedy is this extraordinary laughter record.
He was drawing very much on features of his youth. And there was a phenomenon in the early days of mass-produced gramophone records, as they were called, of the novelty recording. We use a novelty recording, which is consists of very little but a rather bad trumpet solo, accompanied first by the laugh of a woman and then by the laughter of a man, and the laughter just cascades and grows. And these were a kind of recorded parlor entertainment in their day, and people would put them on to induce laughter. Laughter is contagious. We've played to three audiences so far, and I'm touching wood as I tell, as I report that it seems to work on the audiences here at the gate. But I'm superstitious like most people in the theatre, so I have no idea if that'll be a consistent phenomenon. Influential to me musically were three pieces of Eric Satie's, three Nociennes, and he wrote them for piano. They've been transcribed for harp, and they're quite beautifully. The transcriptions of his stuff for harp are very beautiful. The Gymnopédie are very famous, and these Nociennes, they're brief pieces.
Why did Miller become interested in the harp? Why is it so central to this play?
Well, the harp is a beautiful object to begin with. So we'll set aside its great the literature for it musically and the great tradition, especially here in Ireland, of the harp. But it's a great object and to look at. And this play takes place in a room full of objects, furniture, paintings, sports equipment, dining tables that are the accumulation of the Franz family, a family that was very wealthy during the boom period in America of the 1920s, and a family that went utterly bust in the great crash of 1929. And all of their worldly goods, which were considerable, have been moved into one room in a very jumble shop manner. And they've lain there under padlock for decades. And the harp was a prized possession, a wedding present of their mother's, and it's present on stage. I was a freshman, as we say, in the States at Harvard College, and I was just captivated by a Nobel laureate professor who deigned to work with undergraduates on a biology course. His name was George Wald, and he'd won his Nobel for his work on the chemistry of the eye. And he was this fantastic hippie academic, an older man with a ponytail, and who could be found at the barricades of anti-war rallies, and just his humanistic perspective on the subject I found irresistible. I don't think I was a very gifted biologist, but I was an earnest one for a number of years.
What is the story of you being an understudy to Meatloaf? It sounds like a boy chorister couldn't be an understudy to Meatloaf.
How did you hear that? Well, I was still a kid. It was the summer I got out of high school. So I was 16, and Meatloaf was cast as Amiens. And I was cast I changed clothes all night, but one of my duties was to sing It Was a Lover and His Lass, which is also in that show. But I could hit the notes that Meatloaf, who's a very, very high tenor, could hit. I didn't resemble him in the slightest, but I never went on with for him. But I have occasionally mentioned with pride that I was his understudy.
You had done a lot of work on the performing side, though, as a singer.
I was a boy chorister, so that was where my career was pretty much over by the time my voice broke at the age of 14. I mean, a favorite piece of mine was the Benjamin Britten Mass for boys' voices, and I had I sang the second soprano solo in the Benedictus in that, which that's a beautiful piece. I remember I spent a summer as a member of something called the Berkshire Boy Choir up at Tanglewood, which is the home of the Boston Symphony, and a fantastic musician named Brian Runnett, who was killed tragically in a car accident. But he came over and from Norwich Cathedral, and he was our choir master. And it was a group of boys taken from choir schools and churches all over America who were brought together at this great center for music in the Berkshires in Massachusetts. And we learned all of this repertoire. We learned Messiaen. We learned the Ray Vaughan Williams Mass. We were singing Palestrina. We were singing Thomas Tallis. We were singing Victoria. And it was just an amazing, you know, what is it? Purcell said, singing is such a great thing. I wish all men would learn to sing. And it was a great part of my education, probably the most enjoyable part of my early education was the time in that choir.
Doug Hughes there, and The Price opens tonight at the Gate, Dublin. And if you'd like to hear its star, Lewis J. Stadlin, at work, head over to soundcloud.com/soundsdoable, or, of course, the Culture File page on the Lyric site.